Okay. So, welcome back here. And let us continue. And we can now move on to the four Satipatthana practices. So far we have looked at one of these seven sets, one of the seven sets that comprise the Bodhipakya Dhammas. Now we can move on to the second one. Second one being the four applications of mindfulness that we have here. And the four applications of mindfulness, they kind of emerge naturally from the four right efforts. The four right efforts are all about, as we have seen, overcoming unwholesome qualities of mind. And the four applications of mindfulness continue, in a sense, that process. And then they continue purifying the mind and eventually taking the mind all the way to samadhi, as we shall see here when we go through these four applications. Satipatthana is the word here that is translated as four applications of mindfulness. And it is made up of these two words, sati on the one hand and upatthana on the other hand. And upatthana means like something like to establish or to application, or it is related to the idea of upatak, which is an attendant. So it means almost like attending with mindfulness. So it's attending and mindfulness are almost the same word. So it's almost like redundant in a sense. And sati has this double idea in Pali. It means both memory and it also means awareness, present moment awareness, or just awareness. And these two things are also very closely related to each other in practice. If you have clarity of mind, if you have good awareness, your memory will be good. And if your memory is good, it is usually because of your awareness, your ability to know what is happening in the present moment. So these things are very closely related to each other, and that's why the same word is used for them in the Pali language. So that's a useful thing to recall. The sati, as we shall see later on, sati is often defined as the ability to remember what was said and done a long time ago. Anyway, let us start off by this first sutta, another extract from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the great passing away. Again, just to remind you of the context here, the context is the Buddha's last journey, traveling from Rajagaha in the Magadhan kingdom all the way to his passing away in Kushinara. On the way to Kushinara, one of the places where he stops is Vesali being the capital of the Vajjayan Republic, just north of the river Ganges, and that's where he spends the rains retreat. And during this rains retreat, he gets very ill, very, very sick, and to the point where Venerable Ananda feels completely at a loss. He says that, "I feel like a drunkard. I lost my bearings. I can't really have any feeling for the directions and all of this," which is quite astonishing when you think that Venerable Ananda was already a stream enterer, was already a sotapanna. And still, he actually was very strongly affected by the Buddha's illness. So this is where this kind of sets in, just like the previous passage, very closely related to each other at this particular point. The Buddha then gives Ananda the following advice on how to deal with this difficult situation. It's kind of remarkable that even a stream enterer is so affected by it, and it shows you kind of the power, I suppose, of habit. Perhaps one of the, I think, important problems with attachment to people is the habit of having someone around. You're used to somebody, and then when they disappear, they like leave a big hole in your life, and something has kind of vanished for good. Of course, having been the Buddha's attendant for 20 years, then and having been close to such an enormous spiritual master for so long, it would have made a massive impact to see that the spiritual master is about to pass away. So even Venerable Ananda is having difficulties. So this is what the Buddha says in part. There's more, but this is in part what he says, kind of to comfort him or to remind him of what really matters. And he says, "I'm advanced in years. I have reached the final stage of life. I'm currently 80 years old. Just as a decrepit cart keeps going by relying on straps, In the same way, the realized one's body keeps going by relying on straps, or so you'd think, or as it were. Sometimes the realized one, not focusing on any signs, and with the cessation of certain feelings, enters and remains in the signless immersion of the heart. Only then does the realized one's body become more comfortable. So the Buddha is talking about his old age. Yeah, it's like the body is falling apart like an old cart, and it kind of has to be held together. This is metaphorically, of course, held together, just like the old, the cart has to be held together. And elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha talks about his body being like any body that kind of gets advanced in age, where the skin is kind of wrinkling and he's kind of stooping and his faculties are declining. He can't see and can't hear as he used to. And you get this very clear picture of someone who is actually getting older. Yeah, it sounds like an old person, just like any other person getting older. It's exactly the same thing happening with the Buddha. This is very useful to remember this, because one of the problems in Buddhism is that sometimes we take the kind of supernormal aspects of the Buddha way, way too far. Of course, there were things that were special about the Buddha, but the things that were special were more on the mental level. It wasn't the ability to see clearly, it was the ability to understand life as it actually is. But in the end, the Buddha was a human being, just like everyone else. And this is the picture that comes out in the suttas very strongly. It's important to remember that, because in later Buddhist literature, and this already starts to happen in the Mahapanibbana Sutta, because this sutta is in many ways quite late. This sutta would have been compiled after the Buddha passed away, because it has all the events that leads up to the Buddha's passing away. It also has some of the events that happened after the Buddha passed away. So this sutta was obviously compiled after the Buddha passed away. And you can already see the influence of later ideas creeping in the Mahapanibbana Sutta. Lots of things that seem miraculous or seem impossible from a kind of ordinary human point of view. At one point, and we shall have a look at that later on, the Buddha says anyone who has practiced the Iddhipadas, these foundations of spiritual power, can live on for an eon. Yeah, and he's kind of hinting to him, Ananda, I could live on for the eon. Now, it's kind of completely out of sync with what we're seeing here. Here we're seeing someone who almost died. I haven't actually included that passage here, but he almost died during the rains retreat, and he had to use his energy to remain alive. Yeah, and he's talking about old age. All of those, that's kind of all on one side, and on the other side, he's supposed to be able to live on for the eon. And a lot of Buddhist literature is like that. And it doesn't seem as if the Buddha is an ordinary human being anymore. It seems like he becomes some kind of principle that is outside of time and space. The Dhammakaya that you find in later Mahayana Buddhism, or all the exaggerations that you find often in the commentaries of the later Jataka Nidana, which is the introduction story to the Jataka tales. It's all about the Buddha and all the kind of marvelous events that surrounded him early on in life and all of that. It becomes a different kind of person. It becomes much more difficult to relate to him. But here, Buddha comes across as an ordinary human being, someone you can actually relate to. The point is that the Buddha is a teacher, and he teaches all human beings. He's also, in a sense, our teacher in the present day. And it's important to be able to relate to him in the way as if he's someone you can go to and you can ask for advice. You can say, oh, Master, please, I have this problem. Yeah, can you please help me? Yeah, whatever that problem might be. Ideally, meditation problem. Ideally, not problem about your kind of work life or something like that. you can actually go to the Buddha and you can ask about these things. Actually, you can even go to the Buddha with any kind of problem. Yeah, this is the amazing thing about the Buddha. He talks to King Pasenadi and he gives him a recipe on how to slim down. Yeah, getting a bit too fat, old Pasenadi. So you can talk even with the Buddha. You can talk about anything. This is kind of nice. Oh, I just argue with my wife. Yeah, what should I do? Okay, you should do this. This is how you should deal with that situation. Yeah, or my kids are not behaving. Please, how can I get them to behave? Okay, this is just whatever. I don't know what he's going to say, but Yeah, something like that. So, and this is kind of one of the things that comes out of the sutta, that the Buddha is very approachable. He's an ordinary human being, and he has his experience of life is very similar to ours, and that is exactly why he can teach us, because he sees life from exactly the same point of view, except even much more clearly than we do, and that's why he has the ability to teach us. You see, read the suttas, you read about the Buddha having defilements, as I mentioned the other day, before he becomes the Buddha. You read about him having wrong view. You read about him having a child, before he goes forth and becomes a monk. You read about him striving for no purpose with ascetic practices for 6 years before he finds the right path. He's kind of fumbling around, not really knowing what he's doing. The more you read the suttas, the more you realize that the way the Buddha talks about himself, it is very clear that he is just a human being, just like everyone else. And this makes it much more interesting when you read the suttas. Makes it much more interesting because what you get the feeling that here is one human being talking to another. Here is someone who understands us because he has been through exactly the same problems that we have been through. And then he just took that human potential to the highest. And because he was able to do that, we can do exactly the same thing. And this is kind of cool. Is what is so nice about it. Remember that, and it's important to keep that in mind, because sometimes the suttas can be a bit ambivalent, but a lot of the things that are supernatural, actually it doesn't really belong there. Very often the supernatural things are later additions by zealous editors who wanted to kind of elevate the Buddha, and in the process of trying to elevate the Buddha, they actually detracted, in my opinion, they detracted from what actually makes the Buddha such a compelling teacher in many ways. His body is kind of falling apart, and the only time that he has some comfort is when he enters the signless meditation of heart, the animitta cetta samadhi. This, it doesn't really matter so much exactly what that is. It is a profound state of samadhi, so you have to turn away from the body, and only then does the body kind of become comfortable. This is one of those things about deep samadhi, is that if you attain deep samadhi, when you come out afterwards, the body feels different afterwards. The body feels completely relaxed and at ease. And one of the ways of recuperating or sorting out an illness is actually to use samadhi for that purpose, to make you feel better, because it just helps the body to relieve itself of problems and all of these kind of things. But what the Buddha obviously is pointing out here to Venerable Ananda is impermanence. Impermanence of everything in this world, impermanence of the things that are most dear to you. And obviously the Buddha was the person who was the most dear to Venerable Ananda, and that's why he has incredible problems now towards the end of the Buddha's life. The Buddha is saying, what do you expect? Somewhere else he says to him, everything that is dear and pleasing will become otherwise, will become separated from you. He says that specifically with reference to himself, and saying to Venerable Ananda that you should know this. I've been teaching you this all along. Haven't you been listening? It's amazing. He's a stream mentor. You're supposed to know this by heart. And still, you forget these things. It's so easy to forget. And if Venerable Ananda can forget it, well, how much easier isn't it for everyone else to forget these things? But everything is tangible. You can't hold on to anything. Everything is going to have to go in this world. So what does that mean if everything in this world is impermanent, is unreliable? What does that mean in practice? Well, that world that the Buddha is talking about, again, is the world, the world that we are immersed in all the time. The world of the five senses, the world that is around us, the world you wake up to every morning, the world you say goodnight to when you go to bed at night, all the people in that world, all the things you think you own, that you don't really own because they can be taken from you at any time. All the things that you are, the politics and the kind of the everything that happens in that world, all of that is part of that world. It's everything within the five senses. That is the problem, or that is the main problem. And that is what you have to be careful with. everything that is dear and pleasing to you belongs to the five sense world. When you let go of that world, you also become free of the attachments and the cravings that actually belong to that world. This is an incredibly useful contemplation because it really shows you the power of meditation practice. It shows you the power of finding that refuge inside, which is away from that world. So contemplate that. Remind yourself of the danger of that world. It's always going to let you down. You're never going to find that satisfaction in that world. Never. It's impossible. It's impossible by its nature. And you know it's true. Everyone here will know it's true because things always are always going to have to disappear. So it is an extraordinarily powerful contemplation. And it's kind of almost strange that not everyone in the world is aware of this. It's so blooming obvious that this must be the case. Yeah, it is so obvious when you think about it. And yet, it is so hard to really take on board fully and really to see it fully. If you see it fully, you can go into meditation, bang, like that, because you know there's nothing in that world worth holding on to. And because you can let go of that world so easily, samadhi happens so incredibly quickly. It's because we don't understand these things fully, if at all, that is why our meditation is not as deep as it would otherwise be. You will be able to enter even the jhana states very fast if you fully understood that. So there's a lot of benefit in contemplating this. And this is just it's very simple, but at the same time, very profound. And this is one of those strange things about the Buddhist teachings. So much of it is so simple. It is so obvious. When you think about it, it makes incredibly good sense. And yet somehow it hasn't sunk deeply in so that we can actually act upon it fully yet. So you need to contemplate it, even though it's simple, even though it's obvious, you still need to contemplate it to reveal new layers, new depths, new profundities of these ancient and obvious truths. And as you do that, you allow your mind to take that refuge in the Dhamma, the refuge in meditation, far more powerfully as a consequence. So this is one of the reasons, you will see that in a second, why one of the things that make meditation and satipatthana meditation possible is right view, ujjukaditti, straight view. This is one of the reasons, because you have to see the world in the right way. You have to enable yourself to give up those things that are useless, that have no particular real aim, no real purpose, there's nothing there for you. There's nothing in that world to look forward to in the future. That's why you can let go of it in meditation. It's not going to take you anywhere. It doesn't have any real purpose. Let go. Allow it to be. Instead, go into meditation practice. I have no future. I have no future. I have no future in the world of the five senses. And this is why the Buddha says what he says next. So Ananda, be your own island with your own refuge. With no other refuge. Let the teaching be your island and your refuge with no other refuge. So being your own island means going inside of yourself, being independent of the world outside, being independent of the five senses specifically, and use the Dhamma as your guide to navigate that inner world. This is what the suttas and the things like the Anapanasati Sutta is about, enable you to navigate that inner world so that you can actually really make that world your real refuge inside. So, no other refuge outside. And how do you do this? And of course, the answer is meditation practice. And that's why the answer here now is the four satipatthanas, precisely what you would expect. How does a mendicant do this? It's when a mendicant meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. The meditator observing an aspect of feelings, an aspect of the mind, an aspect of principles, keen, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. That's how a mendicant is their own island, their own refuge. With no other refuge. That is how the teaching is the island and the refuge. With no other refuge. So four satipatthanas, which is all about meditation practice, all about going inside by letting go of the world outside. And quite specifically, the four satipatthanas, the easiest way perhaps to think about them is simply thinking about breath meditation. Breath meditation fulfills the four satipatthanas. It takes you all the way to the end of these things. So let's have a look at this description of these four satipatthanas just briefly. We're not going to go through the Satipatthana Sutta this time, but it's useful just to have a brief look at what this, the meaning of this is. So, you meditate by observing an aspect of the body, kaya kaya nupassi. Yeah, and kaya kaya nupassi is quite literally observing a body in the body. And the idea here is that the word body means like a kind of a sum of things, yeah, that belong to a certain group, a group of things, a group of phenomena, grouped together for, you know, because they belong together. So like the breath, for example, would be an aspect of the body. The 31 parts of the body is an aspect of the body. Different ways of relating to the body or looking at the body. These are aspects of the body here. So this is, I really like this translation. I think Adam Sudhartha has got this spot on. It's exactly how I would translate this as well. Meditate observing an aspect of the body. You will have seen many other translations, he meditates or he dwells contemplating the body as a body, is one translation. And it is pretty cryptic what that means, whereas this is very straightforward, you know, straight away what it means. So this is actually very very lucid and clear, and this is why I think it's a good translation. So how do you do that? How do you observe? What does it mean to observe? Well, it can mean a couple of different things. It can mean either to look at, to observe, like you're watching the breath. Yeah, this is observation. So you observe the breath. But it can also mean, and that just means to kind of hang out with, yeah, you stick with the breath, you are in the present moment with the breath, you are observing it. But kaya kaya nupassi can also be an act of imagination as well. So if you are looking at the 31 parts of the body, for example, not the 32, not, is it 31 or 32? Okay, with the brain. Is it 31 or 32? Is it 32? Is it? Are you sure? Yeah? I like this one. This is kind of one of the conundrums of Buddhism. Is it 31 or 32 parts of the body? Yeah? This is very, very important, actually. Really, really important. Yeah? 31 or 32? Incredibly significant. But first of all, just finish what I was just saying. If you look at the 31 or 32, I'll come back to this in a second because it's so important. If you look at that, then it's more an act of imagination. Yeah, you have to think, okay, lungs, heart, something like that. Yeah, I'm really on thin ice now. I don't really know exactly what these things are. It doesn't really matter. Heart, liver, yeah, intestine, something like that. Yeah, something like that anyway. If I got it wrong, I apologize. Is there any doctors here or anatomists here who know every detail? I hope not, again. Otherwise, I'm in serious trouble. But you don't actually have to know where they are. It doesn't matter all that much. You have a rough idea. You know that they are there. And you know roughly what it looks like because you have seen some anatomy kind of pictures before. And you maybe have seen that famous Günther von Hagen, the Body Worlds, that we had actually an exhibition of that during the first global conference in 2006. We had an exhibition of that. You could see the bodies. They're taking the skin off the bodies, and you can see bodies as they actually look. Actually, not even as they actually look. Even they were probably prettier than real bodies because they had been made up with silicon, and they look kind of nice. So this is an imagination of the parts of the body, and so you can kind of see, you get a rough idea what it is. So these are the two aspects of observing, is imagination and also following along with things in real time, as you know, as one of these computer terms, in real time, you are actually with it as it actually happens. But let's get back to 31 and 32 parts, because it is so incredibly important. I want to spend a lot of time on this. No, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, I'm just messing around. The interesting thing about that is usually when you ask people, is there 31 or 32 parts, the vast majority of people will say, oh, 32 parts. Yeah, we all know it's 32 parts. But actually, it's not correct. Actually, when you read the suttas, or everywhere in the suttas, in the four Nikayas, it's always 31 parts. And you see that in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, because it is there, it is in the Kayagata Sutta, and everywhere is always 31 parts. So why do people say it's 32 parts then, if it actually says 31? And this is what is interesting. The difference between 31 and 32 is nothing. It doesn't matter. One adds the brain, the other one is without the brain. It doesn't actually matter. Yeah? Completely irrelevant. But what is interesting about it is why people say 32. That is the interesting part about this. And the reason they say 32 is because 32 comes from the Visuddhi Magga. Yeah? Everyone knows a number in the Visuddhi Magga. Nobody knows a number in the suttas. And this is typical of how we have been conditioned as Buddhists. What we know about the Dhamma is very often comes from the Visuddhi Magga rather than from the suttas. And that should kind of be a little alarm bell straight away going off. Yeah, because it means that a lot of the things that you may know or you think you may know actually is not necessarily straight from the suttas, but it comes instead from the commentaries and from the later tradition of Buddhism. So that is why it is so interesting, because it shows us the influence that has actually been upon us, especially if you are a traditional Buddhist, because you have grown up in a Buddhist culture, and a Buddhist culture will tend to influence you in a certain way, if you are. But actually even these days, even non-traditional Buddhists as well, because they're also very often influenced by commentaries, by, you know, which are, because these are very commonly used in various meditation systems. It shows you that influence of the commentaries and why it is so important to be careful, because in this case it doesn't matter so much, but in other instances it may matter much more. Just to give you some examples, for example, how metta meditation is taught. Metta meditation in the Visuddhi Magga is taught in one way, in the suttas it's taught quite differently. In the Visuddhi Magga is taught, you know, you start off with certain people, the people that are kind of friendly to you, then the neutral people, then the people you know, you have more difficulty with, and you kind of expand out like that. There's nothing like that in the suttas. The suttas just say that if you have someone you don't like, you should have metta towards them, and then you should spread metta to the whole world. That's how what the suttas say. The suttas have a slightly different approach to this. Another important and very important one is the stages of insight. In the Visuddhi Magga, there's a large number of stages of insight called the various jnanas that you're supposed to attain according to the Visuddhi Magga. But these stages of jnana that you have in the Visuddhi Magga, there's nothing like it in the suttas. In the suttas, there's more a direct contemplation of the five khandhas that you find. You don't find this expanded sequence of jnanas. What does this mean in practice? Well, what it means is that sometimes you need to question whether, if you're not making progress, if you don't kind of go any further, then maybe you should kind of go back to the suttas and ask yourself, what is the original instructions for these things? Yeah, sometimes you may kind of come to blockages in your practice or whatever. Sometimes with the insights in the end, it should be a real insight into the five khandhas. Whether these other insights are useful or not, they may very well be. But it should come back to the kind of insight that you're talking about in the suttas. It should come back to the metta as it is described in the suttas. That should always be the final reference point. And this is so important to be clear about what you're doing here. And these vipassana jnanas that you find in the Visuddhi Magga, they can be very deluding and very deceptive. Of course, it can happen also with the vipassana in the suttas, but it happens very commonly with the vipassana jnanas. I have lost count of how many people I have met who have used the Mahasi system. Yeah, because the Mahasi system is based on these vipassana jnanas found in the Visuddhi Magga. And they have come to me and they have said that, you know, I went to the Mahasi center, I was told I was a sotapanna, I was a stream mentor. But I didn't believe it. Isn't that fascinating? It's really, really fascinating. If you go to a center and you are told you're a stream mentor, but you don't believe it, it's absolutely guaranteed you're not a stream mentor. Yeah, absolutely guaranteed. Because if you had been a stream mentor, something would have happened inside you that was so revolutionary, turned everything so upside down, that you would have no doubt that something incredibly powerful had happened. Sure, I probably am a stream mentor, even though you don't know the exact name for it, but something has happened. But if you just have, I don't believe it, because I was just kind of, you know, and they will tell you about the experience. It doesn't sound all that impressive at all when you hear what they have to talk about it. then of course it is. And this is, can be the problem with these kind of systems, is that they often can lead you astray unless you are very careful and use them in the correct way. So this is the problem. Of course, the same problem can happen with the suttas, but the word of the Buddha is the one that is, we've seen before, is the one that is complete, that is supposed to not lacking anything. So that is probably where you're going to find the best information on how to practice insight and practicing the whole path and all of these things. Anyway, I'm getting really sidetracked now. So, but that, all of that just came out of the 31 parts of the body here. So 31, remember, yeah, next time I'm going to test you again next year and see how many parts there are to the body and see what you say here. So you observe an aspect of the body, keen, aware and mindful. These words are important words. These are the words that serve as adjectives or serve as descriptions of how the actual satipatthana is supposed to happen. These words are atapi, sampajano and satima are these three words. And the word atapi is very closely related in the suttas to the word vayama and padana. It means that you are doing this with a certain amount of effort. There are three important words or three or four kind of important principles or ideas you find in the suttas, and it's, on the one hand, it's padana and vayama is one of these. That's the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Then you have virya, which is energy, and this is what you find once the meditation is going really well and joy starts to rise in the mind. Energy comes up, yeah? And there's an important distinction between the idea of energy and effort. Effort is something you have to put in. You have to apply yourself. You have to direct the mind and all of these things. Virya is a natural energy in the mind. You don't have to apply yourself so much anymore because the mind naturally is energetic. And you naturally go to the meditation object and it just happens by itself. And atapi here, which is related to the idea of tapas, which is like torment or whatever, is related to also the word sun, like you're burning away defilements, tormenting yourself. All of these ideas are related to each other in Pali, and that's why this word is sometimes called ardent, translated as ardent into English, because ardent also has this idea of slight idea of burning, apparently. But what it means, that it is somewhere in the kind of between the idea of effort and the idea of energy. Satipatthana kind of goes across, crosses over from one to the other one. You start off, when you start watching the breath or doing satipatthana, using some degree of effort, as we have seen before with the four right efforts. And then as you practice the satipatthana, as it works, the energy starts to arise as a consequence of the practice. And atapi is that kind of crossover between the two. So it is the energy and also the application of mind that happens during meditation practice. Many of you will have noticed that probably in your mindfulness of breathing practice, how you start off having to apply yourself, and then as you go deeper and deeper in the breath, it becomes more and more natural, more and more easy, more and more self-sustaining. You don't have to do very much at all. So this is the atapi, moving from having to apply yourself to becoming more and more self-sustaining. So this is the first part of this. Some degree of application is required in the beginning. You have to want to do this. You have to get into your car and drive to Jhana Grove. This is kind of the first stage of atapi, of effort and energy. And then you have to come into the hall and sit down. And then you have to kind of put yourself in the right posture. And then you have to actually want to watch the breath, knowing what is the right time and all these kind of things. This is the effort that you put in, and eventually becoming the energy. And then you have this idea of sampajano. It's a very quite important term in the suttas. It's the idea sometimes translated as clear comprehension or full awareness, here only as aware or awareness in this particular instance. And this is the idea that you know what you are doing here. You know what you're doing, and you know that you're doing that which you are supposed to be doing here. Yeah, this is kind of what this is about. So you know that when you're watching the breath, you know whether you are actually watching it in the right way or whether you're fantasizing about something. If you're fantasizing about something, it is sampajana that tells you, actually, I shouldn't be fantasizing, I should be watching the breath. And then it brings you back to the breath again. Sampajana is what tells you whether what you're doing is suitable and purposeful for the task at hand. These are two commentarial terms that are used a lot to explain the idea of sampajana, that it is you are fulfilling the purpose and you are fulfilling it in a suitable way by your practice. This is a very nice way of thinking about a sampajana, that it is suitable and purposeful. Yeah, you're doing something that actually leads you in the right direction. That is why it is purposeful. It is heading in the right way. And it is suitable as well, very closely related to each other, these terms. For this reason, sampajana is not just useful in meditation practice, it's also useful outside of meditation as well. You ask yourself in daily life whether those things you are doing are suitable for making progress on the path. Are they suitable for ensuring that your virtue is okay, your morality is on track, that your mind is kept pure, and all of these things? Yeah, and if you know it is suitable for that, in other words, it leads you to, in the long run, to stabilize the mind and purify the mind, you can use that idea throughout your life. But it becomes particularly important in meditation practice to be aware whether what you're doing is the right thing. Sometimes you don't know. Yeah, your meditation is going well and you're not really sure what to do next. And that's when kind of sampajana, you kind of try to find your way through things. You're using sampajana or sampajanya to try to navigate through the problems on the path. And this is how you find your way through things. So sampajanya is what tells you whether you're doing the right thing. Being mindful is never enough. You also need to have the instructions at the back of your mind. And that's the instructions at the back of your mind. That's sampajana, knowing whether you're going the right way or not. And the last one of these is mindful, satima. And this is an important point of the Satipatthana Sutta, that mindful is actually part of the instruction on how to do these practices. Yeah, this is what explains how the practice is done. So in other words, you need to be mindful before you can do Satipatthana practice. That's what it means. You have to, in other words, it is, you bring that mindfulness with you into the practice, and then you apply it to the four Satipatthanas, the Kaya, Vedana, Chitta, and the Dhamma, the four Satipatthanas that we have to, that we're supposed to practice over time. So in other words, this is exactly what I was saying before when I was on the first night. The idea that meditation, first of all, you establish mindfulness. I was saying this is found throughout the suttas, and here it is found right there in the Satipatthana formula itself. First of all, you establish mindfulness, and then when mindfulness is established, then do you apply it in the right direction. This is important because sometimes if you get this wrong, you think that the purpose of meditation is to give rise to mindfulness. This is what the translation such as the foundations of mindfulness implies. A foundation of mindfulness implies that you're doing this to give rise to mindfulness. But actually, that is the wrong way around. This is more an application of mindfulness. So you can see how little things like that, little translations, I would call it errors, actually guide you, lead you off in the wrong direction, because it gives you the wrong idea of at what point you're supposed to be watching the breath, or at what point you're supposed to be looking at the 31 parts of the body or whatever. So these little things actually matter. It's surprising, isn't it? Little things like that actually make a difference in our practice. Of course, sati continues to improve, as you do your meditation practice, it becomes even stronger. But the point is, you need a minimum level to start doing the meditation practice. You need a minimum level of stability in the present moment, of a minimum degree of clarity of mind to be able to watch the breath properly. If you don't have that minimum level, it's just not going to work. And that will be the problem. So satima is an important and interesting point right there at the beginning here. Then it says, rid of desire and aversion for the world. Vinaya loke abhijja domanasa is the Pali. Vinaya, it means that you have abandoned something. This is called a absolutive. Yeah, this is a technical term of grammar. Absolutive. It's a type of verb that means that the action has already been completed. So vinaya literally means having abandoned, having already done this. So this is. And the reason why and how to understand that is if you look at the actual Pali there, Loki Abhidsa Domanasa, and you go back, we just had a look at the four-right efforts before, and if you look, think back to the four-right efforts, it talked about not being overwhelmed by Abhidsa Domanasa. It's exactly the same term as you see here. So in the four-right efforts, we talk about not being affected or overcome or overwhelmed by these things. Yeah. So in other words, that is where the abandoning of Abhidsa, which is desire, and Domanasa, which is aversion, where that happens. And when you come here, you have already abandoned them. And that's why the expression having abandoned these things is there. So it implies that desire and aversion, the main parts of this have already been abandoned when we come to Satipatthana practice. And it's very obvious that that has to be the case, because if you have a lot of desire and aversion in your mind is not going to be in the present moment. Desire and aversion are, by definition, things that take you out of the present moment. Desire always takes you somewhere else where you want to be. Aversion or ill will takes you to the object of your ill will, often in the past. These things drive you out of the present moment. You cannot be mindful without letting go of these to a large extent. There can still be minor manifestations of these left, like attachments to the body and the senses or whatever, but the kind of the strong manifestations of desire and aversion have to be abandoned before you can do Satipatthana practice. And it links in directly with the four right efforts, because that is where the abandoning happens. Now you have abandoned them. So abhidsa, loke abhidsa domanasa. Abhidsa means something like desire. Sometimes it means more like covetousness. This is the old-fashioned English terms. You find it in the Ten Commandments. Yeah, if you, I don't know much about the Ten Commandments, but apparently the covetousness, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property, or something like that. Yeah, that is kind of the way. Do they still say it like that, or have they got some modern translation? Anyway, I don't know. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So the idea of coveting something is like you want someone else's property. Yeah. And that is also a meaning of this, but it also means desire in a broader sense, desire in the sensual realm. And domanasa is a very broad term that means, literally means manasa, means the mind, and do means bad. So it's a negative mental state, a state of mental pain. And in this case, it refers to the aversion to the sensual world. So it's the desire and the aversion, the like and the dislike, of the objects in the five sense world. This is what it refers to. And loke here, for that loke here, then refers precisely to that world of the five senses. The word loke in Pali is very similar, is used in almost exactly the same way as the way we use world in English. Yeah, when you use the word world in English, has many different meanings depending on the context. It can mean like the earth is the world. Or you can say the whole world thinks. If you say the whole world thinks, you're talking about humanity, as if that is a world. Or the world can mean the universe, yeah, as the whole world, mean like the whole universe. So it has all of these different meanings depending on context in English. In the English language. And it's exactly the same thing in Pali. It has all these different contexts, but even more context in Pali. And one of the meanings in Pali is the five sense world. Yeah, the world of the five sense realm, of which the human realm is one, and many other realms as well are part of that. And when you come to the end of the world, Lokanta, that is what one of the definitions or one of the descriptions of the jhana states and the suttas, you come to the end of the world. Yeah, it's the restaurant at the end of the universe. Is that right? The restaurant at the end of the universe? Is that it? Yeah, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I think that's another meaning of this vihara they have in Sydney. It must have something to do with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I can imagine. There must be some literary reference, otherwise it wouldn't be Adan Sujato coming up with this name. So you come to the end of the world. So this is what we're doing here. We're approaching the end of the world. Yeah, having given up the desire and aversion for these things that are still in the world. This does not mean that your mind is fully purified yet. There are still going to be some hindrances there. They are weak at this point, but there still are hindrances in the mind. And the purpose of Satipatthana is precisely to abandon the remainder of these hindrances in the mind, so the mind becomes fully purified, and then you can take it into the jhana states. And to do that, there are two things you require. What are those two things? Samatha and vipassana. And that is why Satipatthana practice is that. It is a course in samatha and vipassana whereby you learn to calm yourself down and to see things more clearly. And the most important thing to see clearly at this stage is the hindrances, because these things are what actually block you from going even deeper in the practice. So that is the loke abhijja vinaya, loke abhijja domanasa. It's quite nice to be able to say some of these Pali words. Yeah, I like and occasionally bring in a few words from grammar as well, because I've always come to this conclusion that if you say a few things in Pali, it sounds much more impressive. Is that right? And if you want to have authority, you've got to be a bit impressive, right? You've got to kind of say things that nobody else knows. And people are like, yeah, that's really cool, that's really good. And then people get really impressed, and they kind of listen to what you have to say. Perhaps, if you... Anyway, so that is but it's quite nice to go back to the Pali sometimes, because the Pali is very fixed. So when you hear a Pali term, it will never change. But when you hear translation from one translation to the next one, it will change. And then it's very confusing. What do you mean? Do you mean this or do you mean that? What, you know, you use this word, this person uses that word, and this person uses this word for that, and you use this word for this, and it kind of gets very confusing sometimes. But if you know the Pali, it is stable. There is no underlying kind of language which doesn't change, which we try to keep intact. So this is the background information. These are the things you have to get in place, and that is when these things happen. That is when the practice of the four satipatthanas happen. And the first one is then to observe an aspect of the body. And if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, what you will find is a large number of body contemplations that you can do. And of those body contemplations, what is interesting is to figure out what are the main ones, so we can focus on the main ones. You don't have to be too distracted by the ones that are not really so important. So what are the most important ones? This is where I rely on some studies that have been done by other people. There's a very interesting book. This is also has been written by Adan Sujato as well. Actually, he likes to be called Bhante Sujato, so call him by his preferred title, probably, Bhante Sujato. This is called The History of Mindfulness. And it is an investigation of the Satipatthana Sutta in particular. And a very interesting one, because what he has done, and this is kind of the thing that is happening a lot these days, is a comparative study of the Satipatthana Sutta, comparing all the different versions of the sutta. And this, if you want to find out what something really is, if you want to find out what the core teachings are, what is likely to be the most original, the word of the Buddha, you have to do something like that, because every school of Buddhism had some degree of distortion to it. And he calls the Satipatthana Sutta the latest sutta in the entire Tipitaka. That's what he says. I think, I don't know if he's being cheeky or whether he's being serious, probably a bit of both actually. And the reason is because there has been a lot of additions to the sutta. So you have to be very careful how you read it, try to come back to the most original. And when you do this comparative study, what you find out, the most earliest, the most likely part to be originally Satipatthana Sutta is the 31 parts of the body. And the reason why that is most original is because it is found in all the various versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. Across the board it is found. Yeah. So if you really want to do Satipatthana the way the Buddha taught, actually 31 parts of the body is a way of doing that. But it's not all. There is one other way of doing Satipatthana, but it's not actually found in the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is what is interesting here. It is found instead in the Anapanasati Sutta. Because the Anapanasati Sutta says specifically, if you watch the breath, you fulfill the Satipatthana practice. Yeah, all four satipatthanas are fulfilled by simply watching the breath. You don't actually have to do any of the other satipatthanas. All you have to do is watch the breath. Of course, there is some degree of insight also with that. We shall have a look later on at Anapanasati Sutta. Watching the breath is never just watching the breath, it's also being wise about it, reflecting on it, trying to understand how the hindrances are abandoned and not abandoned, getting insight into the process. All of that is part of that, but it all happens as part of the breath contemplation here. And this is why the breath, when you read the Satipatthana Sutta, you will see that the breath is right there in the Satipatthana Sutta, but it's only found in the first part of it. Satipatthana Sutta is divided into four parts. Contemplation of body, as we have just seen, contemplation of feeling, contemplation of the mind, contemplation of principles, as Adan Sujato has it here. But the breath contemplation is only found in the first one, contemplation of the body. Yeah? And that actually is a mistake. Because breath contemplation belongs across the board in all the four satipatthanas. This is what the Anapanasati Sutta shows you. So breath contemplation does not actually belong inside any individual of the four satipatthanas. And that is why we can take it out and say that the 31 parts of the body is the most original one. And it's only when you come to the Anapanasati Sutta that you see that actually Anapanasati fulfills the whole range of satipatthana. It does not belong to any one particular of the four. This is the kind of thing as you find out, yeah, and this is why sometimes when you go to certain retreats, what you are told we will do Anapanasati first, sit down, watch your breath, and then we move on to watching the feelings in the body afterwards. And it is based on this idea that Anapanasati is a preliminary practice that you do first, then you go to the Vedananupassana, contemplating the feelings in the body afterwards, as if there is such a sequence. But actually, you don't need to do that. There is no precedent in the suttas for going to the feelings and just feeling the feelings in the body as being Vedanupassana. But there is a very strong precedent for using the mindfulness of the breath, breathing, as a contemplation of feelings. And we will see later on how that actually works out. So these are then the two ways of doing these contemplations. Yeah, 31 parts of the body, and then breath meditation or breath observation. What about the other parts of the Kaya Nupassana? Five elements, for example. Five elements is found in most of the suttas. That is likely to be the kind of the second most authentic of these ones. Yeah, and then we move to less and less authentic things. And you have the cemetery contemplation that are also found a little bit less. And then the ones that are found the least, yeah, are things like the four postures of the body, the sampajanya in all your activities. These things very likely do not belong to satipatthana practice, which is kind of revolutionary, yeah, when you think about it, because so much of the Buddhist world will tell you that you practice satipatthana. If you are aware of your postures, if you are aware of your activities in daily life, you are doing satipatthana practice. But actually, it is very likely not to be the case. When you read the suttas, it talks about the sampajanya. Sampajanya is always divided out from sati. Sati is always the four satipatthanas. Sampajanya, which is the awareness of your daily activities, yeah, is called sampajanya in the suttas, and it's always separated out. These are two separate things. So it actually makes very good sense that this does not belong to the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is the advantage of having a broader view of Satipatthana and not just relying on the Pali, because it gives you a different idea of how these things work. So this does not mean that we should not have awareness in daily life. Of course we should have awareness. But what it means is that the awareness is of a slightly different type. It is not really Satipatthana practice. It is more like sense restraint. The awareness in daily life is to have enough awareness to be able to know whether you are doing the right thing, whether you are living in the right way. Am I thinking? Am I reacting in the right way to the things that are happening around me? Is my mind staying nice and even? Or am I allowing myself to be bossed around by my defilements, by desire and aversion and ill will and all of these kind of things? That is what the awareness should be on in daily life, according to the suttas. So you can keep your virtue, keep an even mind, purify yourself, That is what it's really about. It's not about the kind of Satipatthana that is talked about in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is much more profound. It may not make that much difference in practice, but it is good to be clear about what is going on, because then you will be able to live, we have more clarity about what you're actually doing, and then doing the right thing as a consequence. So I hope you are still with me. I hope I haven't made it too complicated. Sometimes it can get a bit complicated, these things, and that's the reason, that's why 2,500 years of history tends to make things complicated, because so much has happened in 2,500 years. And if you want to kind of extract and kind of compile that into 10 minutes of talking, and it gets very, can get a bit complicated after a while. Anyway, this is the way I view this kind of Vipassana, and this is how I decide what is important. Yeah, and this, so these are the things that I would normally advise people to focus on from my understanding of this particular sutta. Main thing to focus on is Anapanasati, but doing it in the right way, using both contemplation and also just observation. And if you really want to, and if you're really doing really well in your practice, you can also try the 31 parts of the body if you want to, but that is more, in my opinion, is more, if you feel like it and you think it's going to be helpful, you can try it, but be more careful, because it is one that can sometimes have a bit of a backlash, because it can be more unpleasant to do. Whereas Anapanasati, if you do it in the right way, will tend to be always pleasant and nice. So, that is the contemplation of the body. I think I better stop there, contemplation of the... Actually, maybe I should finish it all, but just take 2 minutes, because otherwise we're going to be forever on this retreat, and there is no... I'm not sure if that's going to work out, to be here forever. So that is the contemplation of the body. Then we have the contemplation of feelings and the contemplation of mind. And I'm not going to say... I'm going to talk about that very quickly. And the way to do that contemplation, it is not really... It lacks a framework in the Satipatthana Sutta for how this contemplation is done. It only says that you contemplate certain feelings, worldly feelings, you contemplate spiritual feelings, you contemplate painful, neutral, and happy feelings, you contemplate the mind in various ways, the mind with the defilements, without defilements, the mahagata citta, the mind that has samadhi, and all of these kind of things, yeah? And it doesn't actually give you a framework, however, for how to do that. And that is where the Anapanasati Sutta, again, comes in very handy, because the Anapanasati Sutta gives you the framework. The framework is watching the breath and then contemplating the feelings and the mind in conjunction with the watching of the breath. And when we come to the Anapanasati Sutta tomorrow, I will show you exactly how this is done, because it's very clearly explained in that particular sutta. And then the last one of these four Satipatthanas is the principles. And this refers, again, the principles of the Dhamma Nupassana is a very broad field in the Satipatthana Sutta. There's all these various things that we can focus on. But again, if you follow the idea of trying to find the original core of this sutta, it is the five hindrances, the seven factors of awakening, that is the probably likely to be the earliest part of the sutta, and all the other things have probably been added later on. So again, and of course, the focus on that is the focus to understand the good and the bad qualities of the mind. Yeah, it is about having insight into the defilements of the mind, having insight into the good qualities of mind, and then developing them all the way to jhana and samadhi states. That is what that last part is about. And it again, it matches with the Anapanasati Sutta, the last four parts of the Anapanasati Sutta. So the whole Satipatthana can be done through mindfulness of breathing, through the Anapanasati Sutta, which actually is quite nice, because it makes it very simple. You really can come back to one particular way of meditating, and you can use that. And that is already difficult enough, because mindfulness of breathing is quite involved, and especially if you want to do it properly, it is quite involved, so it's actually quite nice to have a fairly straightforward path to practice. Okay, that is all for now. So please continue enjoying your afternoon, and we'll see you again back again at 7:30 this evening here.